Thanks for tuning in for the November 9th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. In our What's Trending segment, Dr. Alan Aksumit discusses the causes, features, evaluation, and treatment of chronic meningeal inflammation or infection. In this week's feature interview, Dr. Thomas Kalinsik talks about the association of disease-modifying therapies with the severity of COVID-19 infection in patients with multiple sclerosis.
This is Stacey Clardy, and today I'm speaking with Alan Aksumit. He's a neurologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He's the author of a review article in the September 2nd, 2021 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine titled Chronic Meningitis. I knew we had to cover this review on the podcast because it is a fantastic overview of a rational approach to a really vexing challenge all neurology clinicians face, and that's trying to figure out the cause of meningitis in our patients who present with a chronic or insidious disease course. Al, somehow you kept the review succinct, but it is packed with clinical pearls. So first off, I should say it's important to make the distinction that this paper is a review of chronic meningitis. So we're not talking about the acute fulminant, say, bacterial meningitis patients here. There's usually no mystery there what's going on, but you're focusing more on those patients who come in with a nagging headache for weeks and maybe have a suspicious MRI or maybe some nonspecific spinal fluid abnormalities that ultimately lead us to suspect chronic meningitis. So it's those patients that you're really helping us sort out. So can you better define for us, to start off, what is chronic meningitis? What are the actual criteria for chronic meningitis?
The generally accepted epidemiological definition of chronic meningitis is a meningitis that has signs of meningeal inflammation and associated signs and symptoms that go on unabated for at least 4 weeks. It's relatively arbitrary as to the 4 week interval, but it's been used for a long time for epidemiological purposes.
Okay, that makes sense. So thanks for that explanation. Now, walk us through the algorithm you outlined that really shows us your approach. It sounds like first you're going to get imaging. So do you usually go straight to an MRI of the brain with contrast?
So generally, again, for imaging with a suspected chronic meningitis, CT scan is relatively insensitive. The preferred imaging is the MRI scan and with contrast if it can at all be arranged. So the principal things, as shown in some of the figures that were accompanying the paper, are leptomeningeal, particularly basilar area leptomeningeal enhancement is the most common feature or finding associated with chronic meningitis. And again, that's a finding that's principally with leptomeningeal involvement. The other advantage of the MRI scan, it also helps us to image the dura, the pachymeninges, and to see if there is dural involvement in for particular forms of chronic meningitis. They often have dural or exclusively dural involvement, and then we'll use the term pachymeningitis rather than just leptomeningitis in those circumstances. And MRI is very superior to CT scan in trying to visualize that, both with regards to the localization of the findings and the severity of the findings. One of the characteristic things that happens on MRI scan, particularly with cryptococcal meningitis, is this involvement of the Virchow-Rabin spaces and the tendency for the organism to dissect along the Virchow-Rabin space, creating these almost pseudo-lacunes or expansion of the perivascular spaces, particularly at the base of the brain or over the cerebellum.
Are there any other clues on the MRI of the brain alone that make you want to head to imaging the cord as well in these chronic meningitis patients?
Well, that's a great question. There are not specific things that one can talk about that would point to cord imaging precisely. But one thing would be that if there is suspicion based on the MRI scan of the brain that there is a spinal fluid leak as the cause for the dural enhancement diffusely, then imaging of the spinal cord often gives clues about the nature of the spinal fluid leak. So that would be an obvious one. Another one would be if there are evaluations for the cause of the meningitis. And again, the imaging is uncharacteristic or even normal with regards to the brain, then one might consider parameningeal foci in the spine that might serve as a source for a chronic meningitis, a chronic inflammation of the leptomeninges, and therefore would be another clue if the MRI of the head is normal and there's a pleocytosis in the lumbar spinal tap that, there might be another source. And again, spinal cord imaging might be worthwhile.
So moving on from neuroaxis imaging, talk to us about your approach to cerebral spinal fluid testing.
Yes, spinal fluid is critical in the analysis of chronic meningitis and how much to do at the initiation of the evaluation is variable. And I would say if you're interested in details of what to do for suspected chronic meningitis, I'll ask you to just go to the paper because there's kind of a checklist there. And it's my checklist. It's not the right checklist. And it's not the only checklist. But it does help to go through a checklist and make sure that you've covered your bases based on clinical circumstances. Obviously, that checklist detail is going to depend where you are in the country, where you are in the world, what's prevalent or suspicious in the circumstance of the individual patient and their exposure history. All those things will go into the details of what you might want to do.
I'll agree with you. That checklist that's in the paper is now my checklist. It's thorough, it's comprehensive, and I can print it out and fit it all on one page. So it's fantastic. So without going into all the details on that, tell us what studies do you order at a minimum on everyone?
So maybe I'll emphasize three things. One is, of course, cell count's going to be critical. And the nature of the cell count, again, whether it's a lymphocytosis or a neutrophilic predominant finding, those are going to be critical. You're going to do, again, fungal and bacterial cultures in virtually everybody. And if I said there was one sort of microbiological test that you did not want to miss on the first analysis, I would say cryptococcal antigen. Just because cryptococcus has become a more prominent cause for chronic meningitis in the United States. It's estimated now that cryptococcal meningitis is as frequent as all causes of bacterial meningitis in the United States. And of course, if there's concerns about any possibility of neoplasm, then cytology is going to be extremely important as well.
That's a great few things to always keep in mind and on the list. I have a bit of an obsession about always obtaining at least 20 cc's, ideally even 30 cc's, if there's some good flow of the spinal fluid. What amount do you like to obtain at a minimum when you do a cerebrospinal fluid exam?
So that's, a great question. And there are no, let's say, standardized features that allow us data-driven amounts that would speak to that. Laboratories in microbiology and cytology always say the more volume, the better. And if you spin down 6 cc's of spinal fluid versus 3 cc's of spinal fluid, you have a better chance of picking up a positive cytology. And if you put 6 cc's of spinal fluid in for fungal culture, it's going to yield a better chance of having a positive culture if there's a fungal infection than 3 cc's. So bottom line is, as much as can be practically collected, and it also depends on what your suspicions are as to the importance of large volume taps. Obviously, it has to be done safely as well, so that has to be in the mix of that decision making.
All right, so can I infer you're in the 30 cc club as well?
We try to do at least 20 cc's, and and depends on circumstance otherwise.
Got it. I have another specific CSF question. How do you feel about CSF ACE levels? Do you find them helpful?
So that's a great question, and I've had a long, let's say, campaign about CSF ACE levels. Many years ago, with help of my laboratory colleagues, we did an exploratory evaluation of a number of patients with neurosarcoid as well as other causes for chronic meningitis, and looked at the sensitivity, at least in a small number of patients, of what that was. And unfortunately, the sensitivity in our hands was about 25%. So it really wasn't a very sensitive assay to exclude the neurosarcoid as the cause. But even more distressing, there were a few of the cases who had infections like histoplasma, and at least one patient who had neoplastic meningitis, who also had positive ACE levels in the spinal fluid. It wasn't terribly surprising to me at the time, because if you think about it, the ACE level in the spinal fluid is really a representative of activated macrophages in the CSF compartment. And all of the things that we think about with regards to infections or neoplasm also can activate macrophages and lead to a reaction, therefore potentially elevating the CSF ACE level. So I don't do it as a matter of routine, but I will say that in patients who there is a suspicion or concern about CSF neurosarcoidosis, that a CSF ACE level, if it's positive, might serve as a barometer for recurrence of disease. So it's not so helpful, I think, in the initial evaluation of patients and trying to rule in or rule out neurosarcoid. But if they're positive or have a positive ACE level, and then you treat the patient and follow them along and are trying to decide about recurrence of disease and need to sample spinal fluid down the road, it's another marker that disease might be active in the spinal fluid when it turns positive or goes from negative to positive again. So I won't say it's totally without value. I just think that it's not necessarily the sensitive indicator of including in neurosarcoid as the cause for chronic meningitis.
That's fantastically helpful. I never heard it explained from the macrophage perspective. I don't want to get too much into asking just about the cerebral spinal fluid. So let me ask you that, you know, again, referencing the paper, there's a table where you make a comprehensive list of the known causes of chronic meningitis, and you break it down by infectious, paramenangeal, chemical, autoimmune, neoplastic. And there were some things that were really new to me looking at that table. So in addition to the usual suspects like neurosarcoidosis and infections, there were a couple other causes that I don't think about in this context as often. So can you tell me about rheumatoid arthritis? That was on there. And I've got to say, the longer I'm practicing, the more I see rheumatoid arthritis popping up as a bad actor in the central nervous system. And I feel like I missed this during my training. I wasn't taught much about it. It also seems to me like it's difficult to prove. I've had some of these supposedly well-controlled rheumatoid arthritis patients come in with encephalopathies of unclear etiology, with suspected vasculitis. And now you list meningitis. So what's known about this?
Well, that's a great question. And there's just not a lot in the literature about it, but it clearly is a potential cause for chronic meningitis. If you think about it a little bit, it's a connective tissue disease that attacks collagen-containing tissues. And of course, the dura is very heavily invested with collagen, and there is some collagen also in the leptomeninges. So one of the clues about at least rheumatoid arthritis as the cause is that frequently the packing meninges of the dura are involved. Also, it tends to be focal. So it's one of those things that can cause a focal packing meningitis. But again, the leptomeninges can be also affected. So arachnoid involvement is not at all out of the question. And indeed, there can be a fairly striking pleocytosis present in the spinal fluid as well. So it's not exclusively confined to the dura. So yeah, I think it's just kind of index of suspicion with focal packing meningeal and leptomeningeal involvement, particularly over the convexity. I think it's something at least that should be considered. And again, it's often in patients who have relative good control of their systemic disease, or for that matter, don't know that they have rheumatoid arthritis because they have had arthritic symptoms, but not necessarily destructive arthritis, and just haven't attended to those, and then present with more of the headache and focal features on the MRI imaging.
Well, I'm glad to hear you've had that same experience. I will say, too, that the few cases where I've presumed it was related to the rheumatoid arthritis, they did respond well to an escalation of therapy. So that was encouraging.
One more comment just about that is that you made mention about the idea of how difficult it is to prove the diagnosis, and I would echo that sentiment. It can be at least tentatively diagnosed on a suspicion based on MRI imaging with contrast. But if you do wind up doing a brain biopsy, which sometimes it gets to that point because you're worried about an opportunistic infection if a patient's been treated with immunosuppressive agents for their rheumatoid arthritis, and it's important to sort of exclude it there. It does have the kinds of characteristic plasma cell infiltrates and other clues as is seen in systemic aspects of rheumatic disease involving collagen-containing tissues. And that helps sometimes in at least excluding infections and again, making it more likely that it's rheumatoid rather than another cause.
That's really helpful. Another cause I don't think I've ever diagnosed is a chemical meningitis under your categories due to a dermoid or epidermoid cyst. Can you teach me more about that? And also, again, how do you go about proving that a dermoid or epidermoid cyst is the cause of the meningitis?
It's one of the things that, from a spinal imaging perspective, can be picked up because of the parameningeal or epidural location of these cysts, which show a cystic fluid-containing enhancing lesion adjacent to the dura that can lead to first irritation of the dura in the leptomeninges and then even lead to rupture periodically. So one of the clues is that often patients will have a recurrent meningitis superimposed on the chronic meningitis. So they'll have a chronic smoldering symptom complex and then have bursts of recurrence with, again, rupture presumptively of this cyst or proteinaceous material into the spinal fluid, which leads to an inflammatory reaction. The other clue is sometimes in the more acute phases of those exacerbations, there can be a neutrophilic reaction associated with it. And that's another sort of clue that might be a reactive phenomenon. It's not specific and another difficult diagnosis. There are other cysts, of course, that can occur in the area of the base of the brain, like craniopharyngiomas or Rathke's pouch cysts that can also cause chemical meningitis. There, it's just another reason for MRI careful imaging, looking at the base of the brain and making sure that there's not an associated parameningeal mass there that might contribute and cause chemical meningitis.
Wow, I'm learning a tremendous amount. This is great. So let's take the patient who has repeated exams. Maybe their headache waxes and wanes, but they maintain the chronic meningitis. How long have you seen that going on? And for some patients, you know, the ones that go on for a long period of time, in your hands, what have they ultimately ended up as a diagnosis?
So it's a great question, and there's relatively little literature to really help us with that information. There are patients who have persistent idiopathic chronic meningitis, where we do our best to try to identify causes, including brain biopsies, and never are able to establish a precise cause. I'll just mention the so-called idiopathic chronic meningitis. We wrote a paper in the 1990s, again, before the advent of PCR and next-generation sequencing and some of the more modern techniques. And we looked at that time at 49 patients who a diagnosis could not be established, and those patients were followed for a mean of 50 months. The diagnosis was eventually established in 10 of the patients of those 49. 8 had neoplastic meningitis, and 2 had histoplasma, fairly common in the upper Midwest where we are. 33 of the remaining 39 patients, however, had good outcomes despite very prolonged illness. 2 of the patients died without receiving a diagnosis, but the mean duration of symptoms of patients who survived this disease was 17 months, and they had a good outcome in the end. But some had symptoms for as long as 9 years associated with their disease. So it can be a quite prolonged, severe illness. I'm hopeful in the more modern era, we have fewer of these kinds of cases. to deal with. You know, we have the beguiling issues of proving that something is neurosarcoid, which can often elude our diagnostic acumen. There are chronic fungal infections like histoplasma or blastomycosis that sometimes are just very hard to establish as a diagnosis, and it requires repeated spinal fluids and sort of patient's persistence and also the doctor's persistence of doing repeated spinal fluids. So I won't tell you about records of how many spinal taps I've done on a single patient in trying to follow these patients, but it's been quite a few.
Well, understandable. I mean, absolutely. These patients really want an answer. And I have found that, you know, as much as I hate to do the repeated spinal taps, the patients will often say, no problem. Keep doing it. Keep doing it. You know, I need an answer. So you brought it up. Have you had any luck yet with next generation sequencing when you're searching for etiologies in some of your chronic meningitis patients?
It's a great question. It holds the promise, next generation sequencing, of being not organism specific or not organism locked. In other words, it has the ability to potentially pick up any pathogen that might be the cause of a chronic meningitis. But the sensitivities of the analysis remain somewhat still unclear. You know, Dr. Michael Wilson and his colleagues who published about using or applying next generation sequencing to chronic meningitis were able to diagnose a few very vexing cases of chronic meningitis with difficult to diagnose pathogens in clinical circumstances. And so it really holds a certain allure with regards to the holy grail of being able to pick up any organism that might be present. But again, since we're also dealing with patients who have autoimmune diseases, neurosarcoidosis, sometimes neoplastic meningitis, the next generation sequencing is not going to be helpful to us. And I think to broadly apply next generation sequencing as a initial way of looking for causes for chronic meningitis, you know, to recommend it as a first pass test for assessing a patient, I think is probably premature at this point. It's an expensive technology, but you know, if you compare it to things like brain biopsy and multiple spinal taps and multiple hospitalizations, you know, it's relatively cheap, but it's being done in relatively few places in the United States. But gratefully, Dr. Wilson's laboratory is doing it on a commercial basis for sent in specimens. And so it is a place where we've sent specimens and others I know have as well. As far as yield goes, I think it's variable. I haven't had much success so far with my own patients, but again, it's often because we're dealing with patients who have had lots of evaluations in lots of places.
That's a useful perspective. And also for our listeners, I should mention that Michael Wilson's been on the podcast a few times. So if you actually search by his name in the podcast library search app, you can pull up all the interviews where he goes into the details of the next generation sequencing, what they're doing, what they find. So Al, any final tips or advice for managing these chronic meningitis patients that you've acquired through your experience over the years?
So it all boils down to, in the end, if you do not identify a specific cause, what are you going to do to treat these patients? And I think it's a really hard question to answer. And I'll just say three different things. One is that it sort of depends on where you are in the world. Where do you live? What's the patient's exposure history? What are your clinical suspicions as far as organisms? And that determines what empiric therapy you might consider. Probably empiric courses of antibiotic therapy is probably not worthwhile. Now, if you're in a TB endemic area in the world, when I say antibiotics, I'm not talking about antituberculous therapy. If you're in a TB endemic area, or there's been a suspicion about exposure, or the patient comes from a TB endemic area, it's very reasonable to use an empiric course of antituberculous therapy in those circumstances to see whether there is a response either from an imaging perspective or from a spinal fluid perspective or improvement with antituberculous therapy. And the third thing is that after consideration for antituberculous therapy. The next choice is to whether to consider empiric antifungal therapy or a course of steroids. And if there's suspicion about neurosarcoid as the cause of the chronic meningitis that you've mentioned about patients who have chronic meningitis, I know that in our clinic, we often are seeing patients with neurosarcoid as a cause for chronic meningitis that can't otherwise be identified. It's reasonable to give them a course of steroids and see whether there is, again, an imaging and CSF response or improvement. I think at least a course of 6 weeks of steroids and reassessment would be a reasonable trial for a patient who you think may have a steroid-responsive meningitis like neurosarcoid, and to see if there is at least a partial response that would point you more in that direction.
Well, thank you. That is helpful. I appreciate you sharing all this wisdom on your approach to diagnosis, also management in both the diagnosed and the undiagnosed patients. I certainly feel more knowledgeable, maybe a bit better prepared to comprehensively approach these patients, thanks to everything you've shared today. Again, for our listeners, the review article in the September 2nd, 2021 issue of New England Journal of Medicine is titled Chronic Meningitis, and it's by Alan Aximet. Thanks, Al.
Thank you again. I'm very pleased to be here.
Owen Flanagan, and I'm a neurologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And today I'm speaking with Thomas Kalinchik, who is a neurologist and head of the MS Center at the Royal Melbourne Hospital and leads the Clinical Outcomes Research Unit at the University of Melbourne in Australia. As all the listeners will be aware, there has been concern about the risk of COVID-19 infection in patients with multiple sclerosis who may be more vulnerable to a severe COVID-19 infection for a number of reasons, including the use of disease-modifying treatments. Today, we're going to discuss your paper published in Neurology this week titled Associations of Disease-Modifying Therapies with COVID-19 Severity in Multiple Sclerosis. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So for this international multi-center collaborative study, the team of authors looked at the characteristics of COVID-19 severity in persons with multiple sclerosis and tried to determine factors that may increase the risk of severe infection. The study included 657 patients with suspected COVID-19 infection and 1,683 with confirmed COVID-19 infection across 28 countries. This provides us very useful information for our patients when we visit them in the MS clinic or in our general neurology clinic, and they often ask us questions about this topic. So I think it's very useful today to discuss this further with Dr. Kalinchik. So first question is, can you tell us what the goal of this study was and briefly how you designed the study to answer the research question?
Yes, so this study aimed at answering, as you said, a very important clinical question, and that is, how exposure to disease-modifying treatments in people diagnosed with MS may influence the severity of the course of the COVID-19 infection should people contract this virus. I would like to highlight that this cohort was not designed to compare the severity of COVID-19 between people with MS versus people not diagnosed with MS. So in this cohort, this was a large collaborative effort. And the design was a composite, a hybrid design, whereby we collected data through a platform that is titled the GDSI with direct data entry in an online survey by both clinicians and patients, and a federated model of collating data from a range of sources from different regions, including registries and local cohorts.
That's excellent. And can you tell me what sort of parameters you looked at and what the major findings were in terms of the different categories of disease-modifying medications that our patients with MS in your study were taking? And what was that association with the severity of COVID-19 infection?
So as you said, from among approximately 2,300 patients for whom we had valid data. About 1,600 patients had a confirmed diagnosis of COVID-19. The outcomes were stratified as four binary categories, and we have classified the severity of COVID-19 course as a probability of requiring hospitalization, ICU admission, artificial ventilation, or probability of dying due to COVID-19. Treatments that lead to B-cell depletion, such as rituximab and ocrelizumab, were consistently associated with a higher chance of more severe course of COVID-19, including hospitalization, ICU admission, and the need of artificial ventilation. Fortunately for the outcome death, there was only a small group of patients in whom death was recorded as an outcome. So we did not, in this study, we did not have enough power to comment on the association with this outcome. Besides the associations with the treatment variables, and I should have said that the comparator, the reference variable, reference treatment used was dimethyl fumarate because it was sufficiently populated, sufficiently represented in this cohort. And also it is thought to be relatively innocuous in relation to its effect on the response of immune system to viral infection. The other variables, the clinical and demographic associations, were also of interest, and we have confirmed findings from other cohorts, such as COVISEP in France or the US COVIMS cohort or the Italian registry, the MASC study, that the risk factors for more severe cause of COVID-19 were older age, were a higher level of disability, and progressive cause of MS at the time of acquiring the infection.
Perfect. That's very helpful and interesting that you found similar to other groups. And I think this is important information that we can convey to our patients in our clinics who are worried about the risk of COVID-19. Now, tell me, did this study include vaccinated patients? And could you comment on the importance of vaccinations in persons with multiple sclerosis?
We presume that there was a cohort of vaccinated patients, and probably from the tone of my response, you can already gather that this is information that we did not proactively collect. So there was a high variability in the completeness of data about the vaccination across the different sources of data. So unfortunately, we were not able to account for the effect of vaccination on the severity of COVID-19 infection in the context of immunotherapy. This type of study design is more complex and probably better suited to more localized registries or cohorts at small numbers of centers. And I'm pleased to say there are currently researching cohorts underway around the globe that are focusing on this particular question.
And do you have any thoughts on the reasons that there might have been differences between these treatments for these different disease-modifying treatments for multiple sclerosis?
That is a very good and also puzzling question. Now, first of all, one always needs to question the reliability and validity of the outcomes, hence the need to conduct multiple secondary sensitivity analyses, which I'm pleased to say that all converged on the same outcome, same conclusion that the CD20 therapies are associated with more severe COVID-19 trajectory. Also, reassuringly, in relation to the validity of the results, these findings were reported by a few other international cohorts, including the Italian MASC cohort and the American COVIMS cohort. What is driving this difference is a very interesting question biologically. We have initially thought that the first line of immediate response to the COVID-19 infection is primarily conveyed first by the innate immune system, such as natural killer cells, then with the onset of adaptive immune response spearheaded by the CD8 positive and CD4 positive T cells. And only later, after a couple of weeks, an increase in the clonally expanded population of B cells and the derived plasma cells with the synthesis of antibodies. We would have expected that the later the B cell response is not necessarily closely implicated in the early response to the COVID-19, therefore should not play a significant role in the mediation of the severity of the COVID-19. But these results are suggesting that we may have been wrong in those assumptions, and there could potentially be an important role of the B cell in the early mitigation of the COVID-19 severity.
That's very interesting. And would there be any possibility that the impact on vaccination could have impacted this if there were some vaccinated patients included in the study?
The initial data originated from times before the vaccination era, and we see these results even in that early cohort. So I doubt that the vaccination would play a significant role in this association, in particular given that the role of vaccination is mainly to mitigate the severity of the COVID-19 or to mitigate the risk of developing a clinically manifest COVID-19 infection, and it takes time for that response to evolve. So I do not think that at this early stage, the interaction between the CD20 therapies, vaccination status, and the severity of the viral disease would be of much importance. On the other hand, at this day and age, of course, we care about the vaccination status and we monitor it very closely. And patients whose probability of mounting a serological response to the virus that should protect them from developing clinically manifest disease or severe cause of the disease are at a high risk. And there are therapies that we know from other studies, such as two studies from Israel, now more recently a study by Amit Bar-Or's groups in Philadelphia looking at the antibody response in CD20 depleted patients. We are learning that these therapies do lower the effectiveness of the vaccination somewhat, even though perhaps to a lesser extent than what we have initially thought.
And are there any implications in terms of our clinical practice that for our MS patients? What do you think the implications of this study may be on clinical practice for the practicing neurologist?
The knowledge that these therapies may be associated with increase in the risk of more severe cause of COVID-19 need to be taken into account when deciding about continued exposure to CD20 depleting therapies or when thinking about initiating these drugs. At the same time, the risk of poorly controlled MS that may transpire into relapses, loss of brain tissue, increase in disability and loss of capacity is probably significantly greater than the risk of developing a severe MS course. So what that means for an individual patient and their neurologist is that these decisions remain to be highly individual. And to give two examples, in a patient who otherwise does not have any other demographic and clinical risk factors of severe COVID-19 infection, which, by the way, are more substantial in the magnitude of their association with the severity of the COVID-19 course than the therapies themselves. In those patients, such as a young male with no comorbid diseases, BMI 24, and non-smoker, in this person, the overall add-on risk from continued exposure to B-cell depleting therapy in the context of very well-controlled MS, where clearly the B-cell depletion is the therapy of choice for this patient, it would be irrational to switch this person away from a treatment that is controlling their disease so well in the first place. On the other hand, if we think about someone at the age 65, where we have not observed any evidence of disease reactivation on patients' MRIs, where they haven't had a relapse for 10 years, and they have few comorbid diseases and perhaps history of smoking, such patient has already a suite of potential risk factors. And in those scenarios, we should be particularly careful of not adding to what is already a substantial risk of severe COVID-19 course.
That's excellent. And is there any thoughts on if those patients should be treated sooner or if we should, you know, have a lower threshold for early COVID-19 treatment with antibody treatments or other things if they're on a B-cell depleting therapy and they develop COVID-19 infection, given they may be at risk of a higher disease burden from that?
This is, again, a very highly individual decision. In Australia, we are on the front foot and people who are on immunosuppressive therapies tend to be prioritized for the anti-COVID-19 antibody treatment. So I think it is appropriate to prioritize these patients for an early intervention.
Perfect. So maybe you could just summarize the main take-home point from your study at this point.
So in this study, in a large international cohort of patients with multiple sclerosis exposed to different disease-modifying therapies, we have found that the key drivers of the risk of more severe cause of COVID-19 infection were clinical and demographic, older age, more severe disability and progressive course of MS, and that among the MS therapies, the therapies that were associated with an increased risk of severe COVID-19 caused were B-cell depleting therapies, rituximab and ocrelizumab.
A great summary of an excellent multi-center study, and I think this provides us very useful information for counseling our patients with multiple sclerosis that we see in our neurology clinics. I would encourage all of our listeners to check out the full article in this week's issue of Neurology.
This is Jose Merino. Please remember that we offer free CME for each eligible podcast. Simply find the Neurology Podcast episode online and click on the CME quiz link. We offer up to 60 hours of CME for past shows, and all are available online. It's free for AAN members. Be sure to check out this week's journal, which features the first of a series of papers forecasting what the field of neurology will look like in 2035, as well as a study investigating the prevalence and incidence of treated epilepsy in children in New Zealand, with a focus on ethnicity and socioeconomic status. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.